Hello again, and welcome to the Slow Flowers Podcast with Deborah Prinzing, episode 131. This is the podcast about American flowers and the people who grow and design with them. It's all about making a conscious choice, and I invite you to join the conversation and the creative community. A few weeks ago, my friend Sarah Meyer invited me to have breakfast in our Seattle neighborhood with her visiting cousin. I'd heard about her cousin Gigi, Sarah's closest childhood cousin. Gigi owns Windflower Farm. It's a 20-acre farm nestled amidst ranches and the Badlands in pastoral alfalfa, just 15 minutes east of Bend. When she started, Gigi selected goats to manage pastures, which turned into a small-scale dairy. She then added a small herd of hogs to remove invasive grasses, followed by a flock of laying hens. "I just kept adding elements," says Gigi. "I realized I wanted to grow a microcosm of nature and manage it in a way that would be a self-affirming circle." Windflower Farm is dedicated to growing gourmet-quality vegetables, herbs, fruits, and flowers. Gigi uses only sustainable practices, no chemical herbicides, pesticides, or fertilizers. Her farm recently received top animal welfare certification from the Animal Welfare Certification Program, which recognized Windflower Farm's humane practices and how its hens, dairy goats, and pigs are raised. Hello again, and welcome back to the Slow Flowers Podcast with Deborah Prinzing. And I'm here today with Gigi Meyer, owner of Windflower Farm, which is based in Bend, Oregon. Hi, Gigi.
Hi.
It's so great to be with you.
It's great to be here.
Well, we met through your cousin, Sarah, who's a longtime friend of mine, and she's told me about you for many years, and especially since you got into flower farming. So I'm glad that we can talk about the diverse mix that you have on your farm and how you got there. And I know it's going to inspire other people who are listening. Gigi, tell me a little background about Windflower Farm and where you're located, and just give us a picture, a snapshot of your place on the planet.
Sure. So I'm only about 15 minutes east of Bend, the city outskirts, and we're sort of in this sweet little pastoral village called Alfalfa.
I love that. Alfalfa!
Yeah. And in 2005, I bought the farm after a very convoluted road to get there, but I found this perfect little spot. It was 10 acres. I had horses at the time and needed a place for them, and I knew I wanted to get back to some kind of vegetable and flower farming after a stint in Tuscany, Italy, where I was a caretaker of a villa. And learned a lot about just horticulture and various diverse biointensive farming practices. So got the farm and found that it was basically rock and sagebrush. So the first year I had a couple gals helping me, and we basically were pulling rock out.
So the soil in eastern Washington is very rocky.
Eastern Oregon.
Excuse me. Bend is in eastern Oregon. I apologize.
Or central Oregon is technically where we are. But it's sandy, super porous, super sandy, and lava rock.
So is there much agriculture in the Bend area?
So primarily where I am, used to be a lot of alfalfa, and people are going more towards orchard grass. So a lot of hay farms, cattle ranches. I'm surrounded by that pretty much.
So you had to do some work just to make it amenable to growing edibles.
Yeah. And first we pulled out rock and made huge, immense piles that we turned into rock walls around the perimeter of my first little acreage. And we actually had to hammer out lava rock for a greenhouse, and we hammered out holes for my orchard in the back part of the property. And I had, because I had been in the horse world, I had contacts with stables and horse trainers, and found this immense black pile of 10-year-old compost that had been sitting on a friend's place.
Oh, my goodness.
Right. So
I hired black gold.
Exactly. Wow. Yeah, absolute gold. So I hired a trucker to bring it in. And that's how initially we amended that first section.
It's just all that organic horse manure then kind of well-cured, really
absolutely
built your soil.
Yeah.
And how many acres do you have then now on your...
So altogether, my dad bought 10 acres to the north, just adjacent to my property, which was great because I had, you know, gotten into other livestock interests. We felt more land would be great. So altogether 20 acres.
Okay.
And I'm probably cultivating, you know, most of that is in pasture.
So Windflower Farm in Central Oregon, this is only since 2005, you finally get some of the land nourished enough to grow crops, mm-hmm. but you also have livestock. So how do you balance that mix? How did that all, you know, kind of become, you have a lot of population on your farm with your animals.
Well, and they, you know, they contribute great fertility.
Absolutely.
And I knew when I came in, I wanted to grow organically. And I'm also just an animal person. I love animals. We had talked a little bit about the ranch. When I was young, I had access to a huge cattle ranch in eastern Oregon and spent my days on a horse just riding through the wilderness, seeing how the, you know, little microclimates and water and all that stuff work together and running into wildlife. And it was just dreamy. I knew I had to incorporate that kind of experience into my future, wherever I was.
Wow.
So the animals, you know, my sense of the farm is that I wanted to create this microcosm of a, you know, kind of sustainable ecology where the components were all part of this life cycle. So the animals are a huge part of it for me. You know, they're
everything
cool
supports
energy.
the next aspect of what you're doing. That
yeah,
wow,
it's a sustaining circle. So,
your animals now. Can you describe what livestock you have?
Right. So I have heritage forage based pigs. I have a Gloucester Old Spot large black boar and a Tamworth Hampshire Cross sow, and they make absolutely beautiful, gorgeous piglets. And I have a lot of chefs on board that are interested in the pork, and I do a herd share. All my animals are animal welfare approved, and I have them slaughtered on farm, and, you know, basically just try to do well by them, mm-hmm. and that they have a happy life.
Wow.
So I've got the hogs. I have about 25 laying hens, and they have pasture access. And then I have alpine dairy goats. And I just usually have a couple at a time milking. And then I have a small herd of horses. I have the two thoroughbreds that I rescued off the racetrack. And then one of the mares had a gorgeous warm blood cross baby, and he's my riding horse. And then I board another horse. So
wow.
Four horses in the mix.
And then that, to me, would be enough to fill anyone's life.
Yeah.
But you've started growing unique edibles and flowers that you're selling mainly in that Bend area. What valley is that? Is that considered a...
You know, it's not really a valley. We're kind of actually on a bit of a plateau.
Okay.
I'm within the Bend city limits.
Okay.
But it's very rural, and there's a juniper forest in between me and the city. But still close
right.
in. So 15 miles to, I deliver my cut flower bouquets to Whole Foods, and it's just a quick trip to them. I deliver veggies and flowers to Brasada Resort. It's about 7 minutes away.
So you're really the resource for that.
Which is fantastic.
And Bend is a bit of a vacation area and second home area, too. So
yes.
There's a somewhat of a built-in customer base.
Yes. I mean, I also have a vegetable CSA, and we've often added flowers onto that, or flowers would be a component that they could order. So Bend is growing, and it's becoming, I think in the last year, I felt a real kind of sense that, a positive feeling from restaurants, from chefs, they're kind of finally getting on board.
If the chefs hadn't been purchasing your edibles, and I want to talk about some of the wonderful varieties you were talking about with your, you know, mixes like your baby squashes and all. Mm-hmm. If they aren't buying from you, are they bringing product in from across the mountains in Portland?
Absolutely.
Wow.
I mean, the Sysco trucks, you know, and yeah.
The big
Basically,
institutional food
right.
suppliers.
Right. And to be a little understanding of the chefs, our season is short. So for a chef to really embrace local food in Central Oregon, they do have to be creative. I got lucky with a chef up at Brasada, who was a true artistic soul and was so excited about the fresh quality that he could get from us. And we worked together. I sit down with the chefs that are interested now. I sat down with them last month in January to look at catalogs, to find out exactly, you know, try to help them out a little with their menus and their specialty wow. items so that we can target what they'd like.
So then you're looking at seeds mm-hmm. and helping them forecast when those might be harvestable. Mm-hmm. And then they're thinking what kind of wonderful dish I can make out of
right.
it.
Right. And there's certain things that we could just grow so well. I mean, our lettuces, you know, there's certain edible flowers that we can get something in a mix pretty much the season long. So if we can figure out, you know, I'll do succession planning for those things that are just always good all summer long. Peas, even pea flowers, pea shoots, peas in Central Oregon, we can send them out in July. You know, we don't get too hot. We still have cool nights. So the greens, there's a lot of stuff that just loves it.
That's true. You have the intense sun and the warmth in the day, but the nights are still cool, and that's kind of special. You don't see that in a lot of parts of the country where, you know, there's a lot of vegetables being grown. So the greens are they heirloom variety lettuces?
Usually, or? Most of the, you know, because we're small, we try to do sort of the more gourmet heirloom varieties that, you know, flavor is at most, and even presentation. So those baby squash mixes where it's just a beautiful, colorful mix of little baby squashes in all shapes and colors, and then the flower is attached. Excuse me. And people go crazy for it.
The chefs are drooling.
They are. We can't grow enough. And with the baby squash, primarily we grow it in the greenhouse. So it is a high cost crop for us. But we are getting a premium for it, and it does make it worth it. So.
I loved when we talked yesterday about talking about the biodiversity and the fact that, you know, some people only grow food, but having the flowers on your farm, of course, is attracting pollinators, and that's beneficial for everything. Is that why you added flowers, or where did that come about?
You know, I knew I wanted to have this ecology.
Gigi, you were talking about perennials. What zone are you in, and how do you choose perennial flowers for, you know, wintering over?
So initially I'll look for zone 3. Okay. I mean, I'll look for anything that's zone 3 that looks beautiful to me, and I'll get it. And then we'll go to 4, and then we'll go to 5 and look for microclimate. So the rock wall that we built, it's about 2.5 feet high. And it's, we get windy too. So it's both a windbreak and a heat holder.
Sure.
And then we have structures. We have barns, so that's a windbreak and also just protection. So our crocosmia, that's probably a zone 5, would be in front of, you know, on the leeward side of the barn. So we just sort of plan the plantings based on the climatology of the farm. But between 3 and 5, you know, we're pretty successful. We had a rough winter. This winter, below 27 degrees one night.
Goodness.
I'm hoping one night is not going to, you know, of course we protect. We'll mulch and mulch heavily. And once the growing season starts, we're constantly covering with Remay, and we've got hoops that we can run out and put on stuff. So
it's hard to leave the farm then, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
So you also mentioned that some of the perennial crops are in the greenhouses. Is that, are you choosing maybe the more the higher zone varieties to stay partially sheltered that way?
Yeah, well, and even some of the lower zones that are valuable to us. So, for instance, we'll have dianthus in a row in the mm-hmm. greenhouse to get an early crop, and that's both a cut flower and an edible flower for us.
Wow.
And then we'll have a row outside, so that'll come, you know, there'll be a succession bloom, which is really useful. And things like, we will have the Emily Dickinson or some of the more fragile crocosmia we'll put in the greenhouse, and the Lucifer I think is probably a little hardier, and we have that outside. Eucalyptus, I did not expect to winter over, but wow. I put it in the greenhouse and it wintered over for 2 years. I think this last winter we lost it, but it's easy. We'll re-sow it and we'll try again. So, you know, I'm really in an experimental phase right now. I would love to grow anemones because I've always loved them ever since I was, you know, in Italy and we had them just growing. So,
slightly different zone over there in Tuscany, right?
In the Mediterranean, yeah.
When you are planting, I noticed when you were showing me photos of your greenhouse, you interplant edibles with ornamentals.
Right.
Is that an intentional thing or is it just
absolutely.
Space?
Yeah, no, it's absolutely intentional. So we will rotate crops, obviously not the perennial flower crops. They stay where they are, but they're also interspersed in rows with there's veggies right nearby. You know, there'll be calendulas and marigolds in with the tomatoes, and they're considered companion plants.
Right.
So absolutely. We'll rotate. We've got four greenhouses to rotate, and then from row to row.
You'll mix it up.
Right.
Is that part of what your biointensive definition is? Or maybe how would you describe that so people who haven't heard that term before can picture what it is?
Yeah, so I don't, you know, I'm a little uneducated in terms of the terminology myself, but it might be considered biodynamic. You know, I'm not an expert into the science. I just know
for
intuitively
you,
having done research and traveling a lot and seeing a variety of farms, it makes sense to me, and understanding how ecology works, it does make sense to me. The soil has a whole host of animals living down there. And if, you know, I mean, monocropping is just not a good idea. It's not a good idea for the soil or anything else or the crop itself.
Absolutely.
So rotation is really important to me. And this interplanting of flowers and vegetables is really important.
Yeah, I think it's brilliant. And I love also that you have these varieties like the dianthus and the calendula that could be an edible or it could be
a bouquet. Exactly. Well, columbine is another one. It's a really useful plant. And they come in so many colors and varieties. And they are also an edible. They're just gorgeous on a plate.
Oh,
they're so...
They're vivid.
They're so dramatic. And yeah, like little octopi or something. Yeah.
So when you sell edible flowers to your chef clients, how are you? Are you bringing them a mix, or do they specify?
We bring a mix. They don't, you know. And this is a great thing about some of the chefs coming up now is that they're beginning to understand seasonal. So they don't specify. You know, give us a bunch of rosebuds in, you know,
August,
April,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, and they're creative enough to use what we bring them. And of course, it's all beautiful. It's there within, we harvest in the morning and we bring it to them just hours later.
Wow.
So that they can't get fresher stuff.
No.
So the edible mix will come in a clamshell, and we'll put whatever's in season. So it could be columbine early in the spring. We've got violas and violets and calendula, marigolds, dianthus, borage, those nice blue bachelor buttons make fantastic little...
A rainbow.
Yeah, just a complete mix of shapes and colors.
A Persian rug of flowers.
Yes. Oh. And then, you know, if they have a pastry chef, there might be flowers in there that the pastry chef wants to use. But, you know, and I think, it's nice to have a flower on a plate.
Yeah. So flower on the plate and then flower in the vase.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about specifically the channels of business for the cut flowers. Because
right.
You've got some retail customers, some wholesale customers, and your CSA customers.
Right.
How do you make that all come together?
So we sell cut flowers to Whole Foods. And that's
one
a weekly delivery.
There's
one
Whole Foods?
One.
Okay.
And gratefully, it's really close to us.
Okay.
They're, you know, on the way to town. And that's been wonderful. I don't sell veggies to Whole Foods because their insurance requirement is too high. My premiums would shoot up. But flower, the non-edible bouquet flowers, it's my regular farm insurance. So wholesale, obviously, we're getting a lower price, but we can sell every week. It's a completely dependable market for us. They say we're the best seller in the floral department.
Wow.
and the flowers just fly off the rack. So that business has been increasing each year. We've been selling to them for just a couple years, but this past year is really, and I think it also has to do with our really bulking up our variety. So we have, you know, three times the types of flowers that we had last year, and it's just been really fun to have more to play with in the bouquet.
So these are Windflower Farm mixed bouquets. Yes. They're not straight bunches.
No, we don't sell, you know, we'll sell by the stem to, say, a wedding that wants to do their own arrangements. But for now, and I need to market our flowers more because we have a surplus. We have a lot of flowers right now. So I am looking for other markets, and the weddings are great, and that's increasing. That market's increasing, and I love. It is fun bringing people around the farm and having them see the blooms and help us both imagine what the bouquets are going to look like.
Wow! So that we all help get the word out about that.
Thank you.
That movement of, or that kind of DIY bride or DIY wedding party seems to be on the rise from other farmers that I've heard, that people want to come pick their own flowers, right?
And I think as the public gets more educated about farming and agriculture and local food and sustainable growing, I just appreciate those clients that want to do that, that want to pay a little extra maybe and make that statement in their wedding.
Absolutely. And then you're adding bouquets to some of your CSA subscribers?
Yeah, so clients who can order, you know, if we have flowers out there, we actually give a weekly memo to our clients. Also with our eggs, they can order these add-ons.
Okay. And do weekly deliveries, or how do the people
get
those?
We do weekly deliveries. And what we do, we're very lucky. Our drop site downtown is the Central Oregon Environmental Center. And we find early in the year it's not a problem to leave flowers in a bucket of water outside by our veggie coolers. As the season moves on and it starts getting really hot in the afternoon, we don't want them sitting there in the sun. So the Environmental Center lets us put down a little rug right inside their door, and they stay inside in the dark, and clients can pick them up in the summertime inside.
Makes me want to move to Bend.
Oh, you should. It's a great place.
Earlier we talked about your desire to be organic. And let's talk a little bit about what that actually means for someone with such a diverse mix of produce, livestock, and crops. How do you balance that? And you might want to talk also about certified organic versus non-certified, and I'd like to sort of help people understand how complicated that issue is for farmers.
You know, I'm small. We're not even yet at the break-even point. We're really still trying to break even financially with the farm.
Mm-hmm.
Organic certification would be wonderful in letting people that are new to the farm be assured that I grow organically. My sense is that my clientele, you know, I love that people will come out to the farm, they'll see how I grow, and they know me and trust me and get a sense of my total commitment to that kind of farming. So I'm not sure it's been an obstacle for me, really. We'll see in the future if it might be useful for me to get certified, but at this point, you know, I know what I do. My clients feel comfortable with what I do. And I'm, you know, we have clean air. We have clean soil. I think if you practice really good rotations and management, bugs are really controllable. We know to do things like when we sow Asian greens, we put Remay over it. Otherwise, they're going to be riddled with flea beetles and the crop will be destroyed. So there are manual ways to deal with those things. We also plant fennel and dill next to some of these crops that might get aphids. And when the fennel and dill comes up, they are covered with ladybugs.
So that is attracting a beneficial insect.
Absolutely.
That will attack the aphids.
Right, right.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, and on our ornamental peas, the flowering peas, praying mantis somehow are kind of attracted to those. So we have to be careful when we cut because the praying mantis leg looks a lot like a pea tendril. So I always look for them. But yeah, I think, you know, I I've had a little bit of trouble with a currant worm on my currants, and that came up after 3 years of perfectly clean, lovely, prolific currant berries. I did actually break down, and it was an OMRI certified product, but I did spray for aphids then, and that's and the only other time I've sprayed is on my pears, and plums get a parasilia. And I did do a OMRI certified spray for those.
So you're taking the extra step to try to do the least invasive treatment.
Yeah.
Only when it's extreme.
And if something gets really, if I find, you know, these currants every year, I can't control it organically, I'll pull them out. You know, I my feeling is there's so many beautiful hardy plants that we can grow. I mean, a huge variety. So, and my energy is valuable more and more to me.
Right.
So anything that takes too much nurturing, too much intervention, I'll toss it.
I think that's wise. I mean, I think that that whole idea of force feeding plants just because I want to, you know, grow them here isn't really practical.
And there's so much beautiful stuff we can grow. So it's not necessary. Yeah.
You're really addressing this issue that I'm just so happy to hear from you on this, because Bend is not the coast like Seattle or Portland. It's, you know, it's mild over here, and you have a challenge, and you're not really daunted by it. You're saying there's still so much I can be growing and using to create income and support my desire to live on a farm and live off my land. That's hopeful.
Well, and we have a great community. We have a growing, enthusiastic, really supportive farm. You know, it's small, but it is growing, and we've got the, you know, this next generation coming in. I get great kids coming up that want to learn, that want to farm. We have young farmers coming in and finding land, leasing land. And so I feel supported. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, crazy people like me trying to farm in Bend and enjoying it and making it work.
So, people rediscovering agriculture as a way of life.
Yeah, and as we get the local community interested in us and in buying from us, it will be a self-supportive network.
This infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I want to just end a little bit about talking about your background and what brought you to farming, because you are an artist, you are a writer, you've trained racehorses. You have this eclectic mix of loves. Somehow it seems like Windflower Farm is allowing you to bring them all together, but give me a little sense of what a year is like in your life and how you're able to bring everything that you love to this place.
You know, I think the farm was sort of, it was very organically arrived at, and but I do feel that it's allowing me to express all those elements. You know, I just wrote a letter to my county commissioners about land use issues. So, you know, every part of my background that's important to me is still being expressed. And, you know, the design factor in the farm is drawing the flowers and those all those beautiful shapes and colors that come from plants, and designing where they're going to go and how I'm going to map everything has been, you know, has allowed me to express that creative aspect. I do want to get back to a book that's in the works and my painting. Here I am in Seattle going to galleries and seeing paintings and missing that. So the idea of the farm, and partly why I love the seasonality of it, is that in the wintertime I would have time to kind of click back into those.
Return to your art.
Into those careers.
Mm-hmm.
And and it used to sort of stress me somewhat that I wasn't doing that. You know, I mean, I've had the farm since 2005, and there's yet to be a winter where I'm not working on the business or doing my taxes, or, you know, the winter somehow seems short, even though they're considered
or long. Planning for your next crops. Or
exactly.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, doing inventory and but I'm less stressed because farming is physical and I love it and I'm getting older, and there'll be a time when I simply can't go out there as much and I'll be up in the studio and it will come, you know.
Oh, that'll be wonderful.
Yeah.
I mean, it'll be really wonderful to see that the farm inspires your all your right brain creative expressions. There's something so amazing about the sense of place you're at. In every farm, I see this. If you really understand, you know, the ecology and the history of that land, it's inspiring artists. It has been inspiring artists for centuries and millennia, you know, so I can see it touching you.
Even as a painter, I was a landscape, you know, sort of abstract in landscape, and I always just felt like I wanted to be inside my paintings. I wanted to, you know, and I am now. It's a three-dimensional painting. I walk through it. Yeah.
Wow. Oh, I want to see it. Well, let's put some photographs of your farm up on my show notes so people can visit, and I'll follow links to your website. And if you're planning a wedding in the Bend area, you know who to call now.
Thank you, Deborah.
Is there anything that you want to talk about that's on deck for the future or that I've not asked you about that we should close with? I know we've been all over the map with this discussion.
Yeah, you know, the flower element of my farm is becoming more important to me. And I'd like to market it more. I'd like to do more. I'd like to get more clients for our edible flowers. I'd like to get more clients for our bouquets. I'm really excited. And it's a constant research and education for me to try new flowers, to see what we can do. Every year is different. I'm just excited to grow the flower aspect of the farm. So.
Oh, that's great. Thank you so much, Gigi, for sitting down with me. And I look forward to having people see you on the screen, on the web, and maybe see you in person someday.
Fantastic.
Okay, thanks a lot.
In the future, Gigi hopes to make her farm an educational space. She wants the farm to be a classroom that can set an example for visitors to see the potential for sustainable farming and local food in her community. Pasteurized eggs from Windflower Farm's AWA-certified laying hens are available direct from the farm and through CSA shares. Pasteurized pork and goat's milk are available through a herd share program. And you can find her flowers at the Whole Foods store in Bend. Edible flowers and delicious vegetables are available through area restaurants. As you will see in the photographs that we'll post at deborahprinzing.com, Gigi's floral designs feature a large array of beautiful annuals, perennials, and edibles. And I predict that as more wedding planners and brides discover Bend as a venue and discover Windflower Farm's floral selection, Gigi will be extremely busy keeping them all supplied. It has been my pleasure to share with you today's podcast conversation. Because of the support from you and others, listeners have downloaded episodes of the Slow Flowers podcast more than 7,000 times. I thank you for taking the time to join my conversations with flower farmers, florists, and other notable floral experts. If you like what you hear, please consider logging on to iTunes and posting a listener review. Until next week, please join me in putting more American-grown flowers on the table, one vase at a time. The Slow Flowers podcast is engineered and edited by Hannah Holdgertz. Learn more about her work at hhcreates.net.